Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Okay, you know what it's time for?
Slash and Dash!
Slash and Dash!
So, our top city was Chicago.
Well done.
I mean, in terms of...
Chicago!
Murders, you've got it all. So this was a real tough one to pick.
We have a cacophony of murders to choose from.
It must be something about... I mean, I don't know what Chicago's like. I hear it's windy. Maybe it is the wind. Like,
kids go crazy in the wind.
Kids go crazy in the wind. If it's windy, they come back from playtime, like, off their tits. Yeah.
Kids are naughty when it's windy.
We've cracked it. Stop the wind, stop the murders.
Yeah.
Make Chicago great again.
Just put, like, one big windbreak around Chicago.
Yeah, just wall it in. I can't stop. So, we've managed to choose one. And... this story I'll be reading comes from thelineup.com, and it is the story of a couple of killers, Leopold and Loeb. Some of you may know it. So, it was 1920s Chicago. Two brilliant and twisted young men were convinced they could get away with murder. Richard Loeb, 18, came from an affluent family. His father was the VP of Sears.
Ooh, I've heard of that.
Scandal. The young man was handsome, that's subjective, and personable, skipping several grades to become the youngest graduate from the University of Michigan. In Chicago, in Michigan?
Yeah. I don't know.
Nobody knows the state. Calamity Jane goes to Chicago.
Even Americans
don't
know the
state. And she sings about Illinois.
I only know the bits I've been to.
So anyway, soon, however, Loeb's dark side emerged. He took to heavy drinking and gambling and withdrew from family obligations. Well, every teenager's that.
I'm not going to grandma's house.
Yeah.
Fuck that. I'm doing the vacuuming. I used to be to do everything.
The only items that seemed to interest him were detective novels
and wanking.
Now that would be a killer mix. But just detective novels and crime stories. Which, if you're listening to this... is probably you as well.
Yep.
So we should be worried. 19-year-old Nathan Leopold also came from a wealthy household with an intellect that surpassed that of Loeb's. He spoke his first words at 4 months. Bullshit. And parents will always say word. Stuff like that.
Yeah, he was talking at 4 months.
He said, blah, blah, blah. It's a made-up language that he's developed himself. He's producing a glossary in Play-Doh. Gives a shit. He had an IQ of 210. Oh, fuck me.
That's pretty high.
And was a nationally recognised ornithologist by the time he completed
his
degree.
Age of 10.
At the University of Chicago.
Was that like a bird in person?
Yeah. So he put that into like a good use.
Yeah. I know all about all of the birds.
I know every bird that's... too far away to actually hold. In his spare time, Leopold obsessively read through Nietzsche's theory of the Übermensch, transcendent ultramen whose advanced minds and extraordinary capabilities allowed them to watch birds. No, to live above the law.
Oh.
But he watches birds. The young student was convinced he possessed such qualities. When he reconnected with charismatic childhood friend Richard Loeb on the campus of the University of Chicago, it was clear he'd found his deadly double. I mean, they do look kind of similar.
Yeah.
It's kind of adorable, really. He's like, you wear the bow tie, I'll wear the tie. The pictures of them together looks like an album cover for Wham.
Oh, yeah, or Sad FM. I mean, they look...
Sad FM.
They look kind of... I mean...
If a monobrow is a sign of intelligence,
yeah,
then he was amazing.
Yeah.
So armed with delusions of grandeur, Leopold and Loeb embarked on a campaign of petty crime, arson, theft, and fraternity house break-ins. It wasn't long before they grew bored of such misdeeds, especially since their attempts at notoriety failed to make it into the papers. It was then that Loeb revealed his plan for the perfectly executed murder, one that would prove the pair's intellectual superiority. I mean, if you're really that smart, the answer is...
don't do a murder.
Yeah.
You don't want to convince people of how clever you are...
by doing a stupid thing.
By doing a murder.
Yeah.
Unless it's, like, someone that everyone wants to kill, then that might be...
yeah, if it's like, I'm going to murder someone who's invisible.
Or, like, I'm going to murder Hitler.
But they weren't going to go for that. They were going to go for a fucking easy target, because they decided they would kidnap and kill a child from a wealthy household.
Oh, well, yeah, that's great, isn't it? Everyone's going to really look up to you then.
Yeah. They were going to squeeze the family for ransom through a series of complicated instructions. Oh,
bloody hell.
The money would eventually be thrown from a moving train, leaving little room for an ambush by police.
What?
So they won't have a drop point. They'll be like, just chuck it from a train.
And we'll find it.
We'll catch it. The pair planned their thrill kill through the winter and spring of 1924. Well, that's not right, because spring's after winter, so it'd be 24 and 25.
Not in America, it's not. In backwards land. Where guns are good and tea is bad. Tea is sweet.
Oh, yeah.
Nope.
They purchased a murder weapon, a chisel, and used a typewriter stolen from one of the fraternity houses to type out their ransom instructions. Dear sir, proceed immediately to the back platform of the train. Watch the east side of the track. Have your package ready. Look for the first large red brick, those were in capitals, large red brick, factory situated immediately adjoining the tracks on the east. On top of this factory is a large black water tower. They didn't put that in capitals, they weren't bothered about that. There was a large black water tower with the word champion written on it. Wait until you have completely passed the south end of the factory. Count five very rapidly, then immediately throw the package as far east as you can. As far east as you can.
Everything east. And why, like, these certain words are in capitals? Is it like if you only read those words and it says something else?
Large red brick completely immediately.
No.
Remember that this is your only chance to recover your son. Yours truly, George Johnson.
Yeah, that's not your name.
As for their victim, after stalking the grounds of Chicago's Harvard School for Boys, Leopold and Loeb found their target in 14-year-old Bobby Franks. Bobby was the son of a wealthy watch manufacturer and Loeb's own cousin. On May 21st, 1924, Leopold and Loeb were in a rental car when they came upon Bobby as he rode his bike home from school. The pair slowed and offered the boy a ride. Bobby declined at first, but after some convincing, climbed into the front seat. Loeb, sitting in the back, struck Franks in the head several times with a chisel. He then dragged Bobby to the back seat, where he shoved a rag in his mouth, suffocating the boy. The freshly minted killers drove 20 miles to Hammond.
Minted?
Well, I don't see how. They haven't driven east yet and completely caught the money. But they drove 20 miles to Hammond, Indiana, where they waited until nightfall to dispose of the body. So they were never going to give him back. First, they poured hydrochloric acid onto Bobby's face.
Oh, and, my God.
And a distinct abdominal scar. Then they dumped the corpse in a culvert. News of the disappearance spread quickly. Upon return to Chicago, Leopold called the boy's mother as George Johnson. He then told her that Bobby Franks had been kidnapped and a detailed ransom note would follow. After the phone call, Leopold and Loeb burned their bloody clothing and scrubbed the blood from their rental car. Leopold's chauffeur... oh, they had a chauffeur. He was like, why'd you take the car? Leopold's chauffeur saw them hosing down the car in the driveway and offered to help. You would definitely be... if you've got a chauffeur whose job it is to do car shit, you'd be really suspicious if the teenage son who loves Nietzsche is hosing down a car.
These people are stupid. Just, like, don't do any of these things. They're all bad ideas and no one will respect you for them.
But Leopold declined. It's just red wine, he told the driver.
I just drove into some red wine all over the front of my car.
To Leopold and Loeb, the murder was going exactly as they had planned it. Little did they know that Bobby's body had already been found. The next day, Leopold called the Franks household and told Bobby's father, Jacob Franks, to get into a yellow cab and await further instructions. But Mr. Franks had just received a phone call from the police informing him of his son's death.
Aww.
So a worker in Hammond had spotted the boy's foot sticking out of the culvert.
Aww.
Jacob refused the ride. Leopold and Loeb knew something was up. The duo destroyed any evidence they thought might link them to crime. The stolen typewriter, the chisel, a bloodied robe. Back at the crime scene, authorities uncovered a distinct pair of eyeglasses near the body.
Oh, they're not very good at this, are they? And what are they going to do, erase the chauffeur's memory as well?
They traced the eyeglasses to an optical shop that had sold the set to just three people, one being Nathan Leopold. Police questioned the young man, who fessed up to owning the glasses and claimed he may have dropped them during a bird-watching trip.
Oh.
Unsurprisingly, the cops are suspicious.
What are you really doing?
Bird-watching is for wankers, no really. One's As in, like, they sit watching. In those little huts. They have those little huts with a peephole in, and it's basically so they can stare at people and wank in public.
Nope. No, it's not.
It's not, but one time I was at...
But no one under the age of 40 does bird-watching.
Well, no, but what they do is dry-hump in the bird-watching huts. I've been to several country parks where in the little bird-watching hut there are, like, teenagers just going at it.
Yeah, I can see that.
Gene friction. So anyway, on May 29th, Leopold and Loeb were hauled in for questioning. They maintained on the night of the murder, they were driving Leopold's personal car and partying with two women.
Yeah, right.
But the family chauffeur had another story to tell. Leopold's car was locked in the garage all evening. It didn't take long for Leopold and Loeb to crack under questioning. Within 10 days of Bobby's death, the self-proclaimed supermen confessed to being common killers, both attempting to pin the actual murder on the other. So not only did they crack, they were like, yeah, it was him. Like, for all their intellect, they have no strength of mind. The subsequent trials and media circus dubbed the crime of the century by the papers. The public was simultaneously fascinated and repulsed by the pair of young, well-educated men who viewed the killing of a child as an intellectual exercise. During the trial, Leopold reportedly referred to the slaying as an experiment. It's just as easy to justify such a death, he told his lawyer, as it is to justify an entomologist killing a beetle on a pin. Their lawyer, incidentally, was the high-profile criminal attorney Clarence Darrow. Had to do a lot about him in ethics. Quite geeky about this. He was staunchly opposed to the death penalty and knew the Leopold and Loeb case would be a serious legal battle. The public was ready to put them both to death. Darrow stunned everyone by having Leopold and Loeb plead guilty. Doing so prevented a trial by jury, which Darrow knew would result in the death penalty. Instead, he argued his case in a 12-hour speech about the inhumanity of capital punishment, advising the court to overcome hate with love. He spoke for 12 hours!
I bet he was good, though.
Well, he must have been. The plea reportedly brought the judge to tears.
Oh,
I mean, sure, he must have gone off on some crazy tangents, like... 12 hours! The judge was probably crying because he was fucking hungry, tired, pissed himself, needed a wee. But the plea reportedly brought him to tears, and when it came time for his decision, the justice sentenced Leopold and Loeb to life in prison plus 99 years. The crime of the century inspired multiple productions for the stage and screen, including the 1955 film Compulsion and the 1929 play Rope. Alfred Hitchcock later adapted the play into a tort thriller starring Jimmy Stewart.
I mean, that's a play I don't want to see. 12-hour speech. No thanks.
Yeah, we put it in word for word. As for the convicted criminals, Loeb was killed by an inmate in 1936. Leopold mourned his death, but had an active prison life, mastering multiple languages, teaching, even volunteering for a malaria study. He was released from prison in 1958.
What?
I know, right? Where would the 99 years go?
Why is he out?
And lived a quiet, scholarly life in Puerto Rico until the age of 66.
Well, that's not what you signed up for.
No. But, well, he did.
Retirement cottage.
So, thanks again for providing this quick slash and dash from thelineup.com. Stephanie Almazan wrote the article. Great stuff. And so, we have slashed.
And now we're going to dash.
Yeah, bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.